right, so let's talk about diploid and haploid first. The prefix di and the prefix hap are two good clues to tell us what's going on. So we're talking about a double set of chromosomes, and we're talking about a diploid count. We're talking about half the chromosomes in a haploid count. So when we're thinking about those cells in our body, our bodily cells are what we consider to be diploid in nature. Anyone know what our diploid chromosome count is? That is it, 23 pairs or a total of 46, good. So in our bodies, our diploid count is 46 total chromosomes. So pretty much any cell in your body is going to have chromosomes. There's a few exceptions. You know, we know that red blood cells are anucleate. They don't have chromosomes in them, so they, of course, have no chromosome count. But pretty much every other cell in our body does have a nucleus with chromosomes. So when we look at any body cell, we're looking for a chromosome count that's 46 total. There is an exception, though. If we look at sex cells, such as sperm or eggs, then we're looking at a haploid set of chromosomes. Haploid chromosomes are simply one set of chromosomes. That's half the normal number. So half of 46, of course, is 23. So in our bodies, a haploid chromosome count is found only in our gametes, which are sex cells. So we consider that one N as opposed to two N. That's just a shortcut way to represent diploid versus haploid. And this is one set of chromosomes. Do you have any questions on diploid versus haploid? Natalie? This is not in the course guide. This is a prelude to page 129. Okay. I just want to give you a working conversation vocabulary before we get there. Yeah, this is not in the course pack.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Actually, 129 was spermatogenesis, okay. Is where I'm going to start you. I'm not going to cover the anatomy since you guys have had that in lab. Okay, so let's talk about chromosomes and chromatids. We know that DNA can be stored as chromatin in your cell when it's relaxed and interphase, but during the cell division process, that DNA arranges itself into a more kind of organized state that we call a chromosome. So chromosomes can be single-stranded, which means they have one chromatid or arm on top and one chromatid on the bottom, or chromosomes can be double-stranded, which means they look more like an X or a butterfly. In other words, two chromatids on top and two chromatids on the bottom. So a single-stranded chromosome kind of looks like an airplane propeller. It has a single chromatid arm on top and bottom. The double-stranded chromosome appears to look like an X or a butterfly. And you know what? It is ready to undergo cell division because when we divide it in half, each of those chromatid arms are separated into new cells. Since those chromatids are identical genetic information, each cell gets the exact same DNA as the parent cell. Thank you. term for us here is homologous chromosomes. And the word homologous means same. So let me think of chromosomes in this way. Let's say that I've got 23 pairs of shoes. You've got a right and a left shoe, so if I counted every single shoe, I'd actually have a total of 46 shoes. Makes sense? Okay? So my body cells have 46 total chromosomes. That means I've got 23 pairs. That's like every shoe that I own. 23 pairs, 46 total. The haploid set that goes into a sex cell is like taking my right shoe only and giving it to a cell. So I'm only giving one of my pairs of shoes away, okay? And I'm keeping the left for myself. Well, when we undergo meiosis and we have to separate those pairs, we actually pair them up together so that you're putting your right and your left shoe together. I would consider homologous chromosomes kind of like twins or partners or a pair of shoes. You know, you take the two that match and you put them together, and that's how we're gonna progress through meiosis. So homologous chromosomes are same. They're same as each other. There's pair number one, they're identical. There's pair number two, and so forth. Do you see any genetic advantage to having a pair of chromosomes for every one that we've got? What if you damage one, you got another one. It's a backup plan, exactly. So that's the benefit of having a pair of chromosomes for all 23 that we've got. So the last term here, homologous chromosomes, these are partners. They are the same chromosome. Chromosomes are the same, so they're like a pair of shoes, they belong together, and that's how we're going to work with meiosis today. Do you have any questions on our new terms? Each arm that sticks up or down is a chromatid, but the whole thing is a chromosome. And like the double-stranded one, it just happens to have two arms on top and two arms on the bottom.
Now, that may consider the X and Y?
Yeah, X and Y, in fact, are double-stranded chromosomes as well. Yeah, sure is. That's good. I know you all have had mitosis back in Bio 210, so I'd like to remind you of how that works in our conversation today. Mitosis is a type of division that occurs in body cells. A fancy word for the body is somatic, so our somatic cells undergo a simple cloning process that produces genetically identical cells to the parent cell. So the chromosome count remains the same. If you have 46 chromosomes in the parent cell, the daughter cell is going to have 46 chromosomes as well. So we consider mitosis to be like asexual reproduction. It's considered cell cloning. Now, meiosis, or meiosis, however you like to say it, is a little different. This is how we produce sex cells, and the process here undergoes two divisions because we have to strip down 46 chromosomes to 23, and we have to pare down the double-stranded chromosome to a single-stranded chromosome. So the end result is actually a genetically set of cells that are different from one another, and that's why siblings don't look exactly alike. There's the genetic variability that comes from having chromosomes cross over during this meiosis division process. That also means that no two sperm and no two eggs are exactly identical. They're all going to contain slightly different bits of DNA that were kind of distributed differently during that meiosis process. Okay. Anybody need a picture or want to jot any of this down before I flip slides? I'll stay out of your picture zone there.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
As far as the diploid and the haploid, you put two in and one in?
That's shortcut writing. If I'm going to say diploid, I can say two in, and people would know that two in means two sets of chromosomes or two populations of chromosomes. One, of course, one in being haploid, half the normal set of chromosomes.
Which is
23. It's just shorthand. Okay, anybody else need the screen? Okay, so I do want to emphasize that meiosis is only for sex cell production. It's sometimes called reduction division, and we do progress through meiosis one and meiosis two. This is the end goal. Like I mentioned a minute ago, we're going to take diploid cells, reduce them to haploid. We're going to take double-stranded chromosomes and separate them to single-stranded. So our end result here is haploid. That means 23 chromosomes, single-stranded chromosomes, and each cell reproduce. And the normal thing is one cell makes four sex cells in a male. And in the female, we also make four, but actually the important one is the gamete known as an egg. And the other three cells that are produced are considered junk packets of DNA. They're called polar bodies. So the end result here is ultimately four haploid single-stranded cells in the sex cell production process. So again, I'll pause here if anybody would like a picture of this.
It's online, right?
These are new that I added just this week, so they're not in the PowerPoint on D2L. No, these three slides here I just added in. I usually write on the board, but I just didn't have a lot of board space this time.
So, the female haploid cells that's made, one of them will be an egg, the other three you said are junk cells?
That's correct. One's an egg. Discard them. Females discard them in their vaginal fluids. They're not able to be fertilized, so they're just not useful for reproduction. Correct. Yeah, all four can be used as sperm. Yeah. All right. So what I'd like to do is show you this little picture process that's on the PBS website, and they compare mitosis and meiosis side by side. It's really cool because you can see how the changes are very similar through part of the process, and then how meiosis is yet a second cycle. I think it's logged me out. Let me log back in. Okay, so when we compare mitosis and meiosis side by side, you'll notice for the first portion here, everything looks identical in interphase. Everything looks pretty similar during prophase, but where you really start to see the differences emerge, let's take a look at metaphase. Okay, on the left, you're looking at a picture of mitosis, and you'll notice that they're only using a representative four chromosomes here. There's just not enough room to put 46 across that line. But those four double-stranded chromosomes are lined up across the metaphase plate during mitosis. Notice over here in meiosis, you have four chromosomes, double-stranded, but they have paired up with their partners. Their partners are called the homologous chromosome. So they are showing you different colors here, not to be confusing, but so that you can see that there's actually two of the same length that are pairing up together on that particular metaphase plate region. So these are homologs, and so are these. And as we go through anaphase next, you'll notice that they're going to separate. But notice we separate the entire double-stranded chromosome from its homologous chromosome, which is heading toward the opposite end of that cell. Back when you studied mitosis, you studied that we separated sister what? Chromatids. Yes, yeah, so right here during mitosis, the sister chromatid separated. But over here during meiosis, we separate those whole entire double-stranded chromosomes. So here at the end of meiosis one, we have already separated 23 double-stranded chromosomes away from 23 double-strandeds. So we've already accomplished reducing our chromosome count from diploid down to haploid, just in the first reproduction division process. All right, so we finished telophase. And as we continue to click through, you're noticing that mitosis is done. It's got two cells genetically identical. And then we're going to follow what happens with meiosis. Now we're going through the second division process. And this time we're taking 23 double-stranded chromosomes in the top cell, laying them down on the metaphase plate, 23 double-stranded chromosomes in the bottom cell. And so what are we going to do to those double-stranded chromosomes? Separate them, right? And you separate double-stranded chromosomes into what? Single-stranded, yeah. So you'll notice that during anaphase here, that's in fact what we've done. And there you go. You're going to make four total sex cells, each one containing 23 single-stranded chromosomes. So big picture-wise, why is it important that we do this for sex cells? Okay, so what's the point of egg and sperm? Fertilization, babies, right? Okay, so if you're going to put 46 plus 46, you're going to get 92. The normal person has how many chromosomes? 46, yeah. So to get a normal 46 count, we actually have to start with half the chromosomes. So mom and dad each contribute only 23 chromosomes to the new individual. So that's why we have to go through this reduction division. We get the chromosome count reduced by half. So egg has half and sperm has half that DNA. So sperm actually are going to be following this exact process. Females and egg production is a little different, but the end result still makes one viable egg and three junk polar body cells that females discard. So any questions about the whole goal here of meiosis or what we did? No, I'm going to take you through basically meiosis one and then meiosis two. We're going to generalize so we don't have to know all those individual phases. Makes it a lot easier for us.
Is there a lot of different
kinds? There's not. Considering 125 questions, you've got like about 10, 11 chapters this term. This one may have 10 or 11 questions in total. I'm going to hit what you need to know, and plus page 140 has a summary page of need-to-know questions. I think I remember that right. Yeah. I do have people make A's on the final, but they're people who've made A's all term. So, yeah, but it's certainly possible to make an A on the final. Yeah. If you make what all semester? Most likely. I mean, I have people come in and who have, you know, an anxiety attack and don't do what their normal test average is. But, yeah, people normally do about where their test average sits on the final exam. Yeah. So you have a picture that looks like this in your course pack on the bottom of page 129. Let me label that for you, and then we're going to use that kind of as our guide for what happens during sperm production. They're part of the same partner group, like a pair of shoes. Can y'all see okay? Is there a glare on there? Okay, so we're going to start with the process of making sperm, and this process begins for males at the time of puberty, which may occur, you know, in the tween to early teen years. This process does begin with the release of GnRH, known as gonadotropic releasing hormone. Where is GnRH made? Hypothalamus, good. It targets the anterior pituitary to release two hormones. They are?
FSH and
LH, good. FSH is going to promote spermatogenesis, which is what we're looking at here. LH promotes hormone production by the testes. What is the main hormone made by the testes? Testosterone, good. So those two hormones have to kick on in production before males produce sperm. And of course, sperm production can occur throughout a male's lifetime. The only thing that tends to affect males, you know, females go through menopause. Males tend to have sperm that swim a little slower. A young man's sperm may swim to an egg within 2.5 hours. An old man's sperm may take 2.5 days. Yeah, so the catch is the sperm only live for 48 to 72 hours. So when you hear about old men like Hugh Hefner having babies in their 80s, that's some kind of magic going on there, you know? Sperm don't live hardly long enough to get to the egg before they die. So there's some either good magic or some technology involved in that kind of pregnancy. So let's start up here with the spermatogonium. The spermatogonium is the stem cell in the testes, and it is diploid. So how many chromosomes does it have? 46. Yeah, it's got 46 chromosomes. And so I'll put 2N next to it because that's just the shortcut way for writing diploid. These spermatogonia are in the testes. They divide. Some of the cells go back to the stem cell line, and others continue on to make sperm.
They said that happens in the testes.
That happens in the testes.
What do you get? Like 46.
Yeah, 46, which is 2N. So by the process of mitosis, we produce more spermatocytes. These spermatocytes are called primary spermatocytes. Since we start with a diploid cell, what kind of chromosome count do the primary spermatocytes have? Are they diploid or are they haploid? They're diploid, yes. So these primary spermatocytes, because they're made by way of mitosis, are going to be diploid in nature. That means they too have 46 chromosomes. We can call that 2N.
Are we still in the testes?
Still in the testes, yeah.
Was this whole thing in the testes?
Everything down to this process here is in the epididymis. So primary spermatocytes divide. They're going to go from a diploid state to a haploid state. So these secondary spermatocytes that are made are haploid, which is 23 chromosomes or 1N. I'm not putting butterflies up there. Those are supposed to represent our diploid set up here. This single one is going to be a haploid representation. And our secondary spermatocytes still have too much DNA. They're diploid in nature, or rather they're double-stranded in nature. So they've got to get rid of one of those excess chromatids. So we have to undergo meiosis too. And that's going to help us reduce the chromosomes from double-stranded to single-stranded. So these spermatids finally have the correct amount of DNA. They are single-stranded in nature. So let me give you a helpful hint when you're trying to keep this straight. Look at the length of the words, spermatogonium, and then spermatocyte, and then spermatid, and then sperm. As we progress through the division process, we go from really long words to the really shortest word. So spermatogonia are the stem cells. They divide by mitosis to give you diploid primary spermatocytes. they undergo meiosis one to give you secondary spermatocytes that are now haploid but still double-stranded. So we undergo yet a second division called meiosis two to give us single-stranded but still haploid cells. You'll notice that spermatids are around. They don't necessarily look like sperm, do they? Genetically, they're there. They're the right chromosome count. Everything is good. But we have to reduce the cytoplasm around the DNA to make a viable swimming sperm. So the very last process that occurs here transforms a spermatid into a sperm, and that process is known as spermiogenesis. Okay, so spermiogenesis is a separate process. So spermiogenesis is a streamlining process. This is how we transform, you know, round spermatids into swimming sperm. I'm going to show you a picture, but I'm going to lower that screen. Anybody need a picture of this before we go forward? I'm not going to erase. I'm just going to lower the screen. I'm going to leave it there in case we need it. Okay, so when you streamline sperm, you end up taking away your extra cytoplasm. You put a helmet called an acrosome around the DNA. And in this picture, the acrosome is a yellow color. That acrosome contains enzymes that rupture when that head of the DNA or the head of the sperm hits against the wall of a female's egg. And so the whole goal here is to help break down the membrane that surrounds the female's egg and allow for fertilization to occur. In one ejaculation, there may be more than 100 or 200 million sperm, so many of them are lost in a female's acidic vaginal fluids, and other sperm basically commit suicide by ramming headfirst against the female's egg. So you may wonder why so many sperm are necessary. It's because it takes the crowd to get that one functional sperm to the egg to create a fertilized egg. So once the one sperm makes its way across the membrane of the egg, there's a chemical change that prevents any further sperm from coming in. So that prevents a condition called polyspermy. We don't necessarily need six sperm inside of an egg. That would create way too much DNA. So this is how a functional sperm should look. It's streamlined into a head region where the DNA is housed. There's a mid-piece with a bunch of mitochondria right below. And then there may be one, or in some cases more than one, flagellum, which allows that sperm to swim to the egg. Speaking of pathways of sperm, let's go back and take a look at the actual pathway. So we know that sperm produced in the testes, that process is called spermatogenesis. And then we move to the epididymis here, where we see the process of spermiogenesis take place. Spermiogenesis streamlines spermatids into sperm, and after about 10 weeks' time of total development, those swimming sperm are then capable of being ejaculated into a female's reproductive tract. So it takes about 64 to 72 days from the very first spermatogonium until a viable sperm is produced. During ejaculation, sperm are moved from the epididymis by waves of peristalsis through this tube. This tube is known as what? Vas deferens, good. It passes through an opening in the male's body called the what canal? Inguinal canal, good. That particular tube travels to the back side of the bladder, and it picks here a gland to travel through first, known as the seminal vesicles. What type of secretions do the seminal vesicles contribute to the formation of semen? Let's go back. Let's see. What's wrong? maybe we passed it already. Yep, there we go. So seminal vesicles contribute a yellowish fluid that activates sperm that allows them to begin swimming. And these contributions are around 60% of what we find in semen. There, of course, is the name seminal that kind of sounds like semen. All right, so the next place we travel through is this little tiny tube here known as what? Good, ejaculatory duct. And it is surrounded by another gland known as?
Prostate,
good. And the prostate contributes milky fluids and sugars like fructose to the process of making semen. So that's why the prostate is needed. And then actually the first gland to secrete anything is this one here called the bulbourethral or Cowper's gland. And it makes a clear mucousy fluid to help secrete and cleanse the urethra of any acidic urine. You know, acid is not the friend for sperm. It kills sperm, so that's one reason we need this fluid to cleanse the pathway first. And in this picture, they actually don't show it, but at this one, you can see that it sits down here at the base. Okay, so finally, from this point, we have now entered into the urethra, and there's three main regions of the urethra. What is this portion called?
Prostatic,
good. And the next region?
Membranous.
And then we travel the shaft. Spongy urethra, good. So, you know, they say men don't have PMS, but in fact, there is prostatic, membranous, spongy, there is PMS in the male urethra. Okay. So, that is the pathway out for the male. I did want to mention, since we're on the topic of hormones, is to flip you over to page 130 and mention that's what we were talking about earlier there with GnRH and FSH and LH. One new hormone you may not have heard of is called inhibin, and like the name implies, it inhibits production of sperm. It keeps there from being too many sperm in the testes. So if sperm count is too high, inhibin counteracts the job, I guess you would say, of FSH. Okay, since we're on the topic, and not in your course pack, but something I did want to mention before you leave this course, what is a vasectomy? Cut vas deferens, right. So if the vas deferens is cut, what can no longer leave the testes?
Sperm.
Okay, so what happens to the sperm?
They die,
good. And what system picks up all these excess fluids and dead sperm?
Lymphatic,
good. So the lymphatic vessels, blood vessels, and nerves all travel with the vas deferens in the spermatic cord. So that's how the testes don't swell with all these dead sperm that are not being ejaculated. Does a vasectomy interfere with testosterone production? No, because we're not interfering with the testes. And do we interfere with testosterone distribution to the body? No, because we're not cutting the blood supply either. So I just wanted to mention that because that's something, you know, people commonly have misconceptions about. I just wanted to mention that since it is something that's relevant to what we discussed here. All right, so I didn't cover the anatomy, but do you have any questions on that from lab? Okay. Why don't we do the same process of oogenesis for females? It's very similar to what we've just covered. And in your course pack, it's over on page 135. Surprisingly, there's a lot of similarities between male and female reproductive anatomy. You know, we often think that we're so anatomically different in those ways, but early on in development, male babies and female babies are very difficult to tell apart. For instance, the clitoris in a female develops into the head of the penis for a male. The scrotum of a male is the same structure as the labia majora for a female. Now, internally, though, we're different because females have their ductwork laying inside, where males have most of their ductwork on the outside. So I did want to mention that ovaries are the production site for eggs or ova, and you'll notice that they are going to enter into this fallopian tube, which is the normal place for a fertilization event to occur. You probably notice that there is a bit of space between the ovary and the tube. They don't touch, so how does the egg know to go in the fallopian tube? Suction. Yeah, there's cilia that say, hey, come this way. They are literally pulled by sweeping action of cilia into that fallopian tube, and that is where sperm are going to be attracted to it and meet up with it. Sperm actually chemically smell an egg, so they're attracted to the chemical composition or the chemical secretions that egg lets off. And so even if the egg is out here in the pelvic cavity, sperm will follow it wherever it goes. I did mention that because there are very rare cases of pregnancies that have occurred and survived full term where babies have been formed outside the uterus, outside the fallopian tube. There was a story recently of a woman in India in her 60s who had experienced pains in her 20s. Well, what had happened was she was full term pregnant. The baby had formed outside of her reproductive system, and very rare for this to occur, but it completely grew without a direct blood supply to the placenta, the uterus, and of course it wasn't sitting in a muscular womb like we see with the uterus. So the pains she experienced were labor pains. Well, because the baby wasn't in the uterus, there was no way to expel it from the body. So after some time, the labor pains went away, and she thought, hey, whatever it was, it's gone, I'm good to go. Well, 40-some years later, in her 60s, she went and had horrible pains in her side. They found that she had a entombed dead baby inside of her that had been there for 40-some years. It had calcified, and the calcified, it was like a hard rock in her that is what they had to remove. So very rare instance for something like that to happen, but nonetheless, ectopic pregnancies where implantation occurs in the fallopian tube commonly can happen. Pelvic pregnancies are rare, but nonetheless, the point is that egg must be suctioned into that fallopian tube by a current. Otherwise, it can end up elsewhere in the body. So, what is it about the uterus that makes it an ideal location for the implantation of a fertilized egg? Why is it better than a fallopian tube? It stretches, it's got blood supply, it's a shelter, it's a womb, and it's muscular. So the endometrial lining in here has a great blood supply to nourish and form a placenta that nourishes the growing baby. And the myometrium in here is a smooth muscle layer that helps to expand. In fact, in a full-term pregnancy, the myometrium and the fundus up here can reach up to your xiphoid process. Imagine what that does to your organs, right? Your rectum and stuff is sitting pushed in places it's never been before. So, yeah, this is a great organ that's built for the nourishment and delivery of a fetus. I did want to show you how a typical egg looks. You know, it's not like a sperm where it's just out there left up to its own devices. As typical of females, it has to have a prissy little package. And so you see around this egg is a ring of cells called the corona radiata, and otherwise known as the follicle. So right here is the egg. There's the nucleus in the middle. It is in fact the biggest cell in a human body. You can see it on the head of a pin. It's that big. This ring of cells that go around the outside, this is called the follicle. Technically those cells are called the radiating crown or the corona radiata. But you know, I mentioned all those sperm are gonna commit suicide by ramming headfirst against the follicle. They're trying to break down that follicle to get past this membrane into the egg to fertilize it. So that's what your egg is. It's not just an egg by itself. It's actually in a neat little package with the follicle surrounding it. So when ovulation occurs, like you see in this picture, it's not just the egg that's ovulated, but its neat little package of follicle comes with it as well. So, in fact, those eggs rupture off the surface of a typical ovary, kind of like a blister. They pop off the surface, and then we're relying on the cilia action to pull that egg down into the fallopian tube. So, a young woman may have a few pockmarks from where the blisters of follicles and eggs have been removed from the surface of the ovary. A woman closer to menopause will have an ovary that's very pockmarked from lots of those eggs blistering off the surface. Okay, so this is a really similar process to making sperm. Let's see, why don't we work over here on this space and we'll just map out what you've got in your course pack for it. they call it graphene. It depends on what stage of development it's in. Sometimes it's called primary or secondary, and secondaries are sometimes called graphene. Yeah, that's correct. Okay, so let's do oogenesis. So the process for females is actually a little different for males. The current science says that females form all their oogonia before they're born. That is not the case for a male. Males are constantly producing sperm and can so throughout their entire lifetime once they've hit puberty. But in females, the current science says that females are born with about 400,000 primary oocytes that are formed by way of mitosis from this oogonium. So there is a little research that says that females may be able to make more oocytes as their life progresses, but you know, 400,000 may be all we're dealt with to make all the babies that, you know, that are born. So if you think about how long these oocytes are sitting around, if they in fact are formed before birth and all of those are sitting there and waiting, if a woman is 40 years old having a baby, that oocyte has been in her body for 40 years. So that's a long time for these oocytes to hang around and wait. So the oocytes are going to start maturing at the puberty age, you know, somewhere between 8 and 14 or 16 for females. And every month, one of these oocytes will go through a maturation process that takes 2 to 3 months. So let's take a female. In January, one of her primary oocytes may start to mature. By March or April, it may be ready for ovulation. So when it's ready for ovulation, that means it is transformed from a primary oocyte into what? Secondary, that's right. How is a primary oocyte genetically different from a secondary? Yeah, 2N for the primary oocyte, 1N for the secondary. Good. You're exactly right. It's going to make a bigger cell, and we're going to make junk cells starting now called polar bodies, which are going to be teeny tiny. Secondary oocyte is what is ovulated. So every day during a 28-day cycle, considering that's the average length of time, around day 14, a female will release one of her oocytes. It is a secondary oocyte that is only completed to the process of meiosis one. So it hasn't even finished meiosis two yet. It is just still sitting there with double-stranded chromosomes. So it travels down into the fallopian tube, and it may encounter a sperm or it may not. Now, the easy story is if there's no sperm there in the fallopian tube, this will be the end of the story. That oocyte will last about a day. If it's not fertilized, it dies and it's sloughed off in a female's vaginal fluids and she has no idea that it's been lost, okay? So easy story is this, no fertilization, that's the end of our process right there, okay? Of course, we're not going to take the easy road, we got to take the other road. If that oocyte is fertilized by a sperm that's present in the fallopian tube, there is a problem with the secondary oocyte. Yes, it's haploid, but it has double-stranded chromosomes. So we have only completed meiosis one. We now need to complete meiosis two once fertilization has occurred. It's double-stranded, that's right.
So once it's two, does that make it single-stranded?
It does, it makes it single-stranded.
But it's fertilized in the secondary oocyte.
It is fertilized at the secondary oocyte, that's right. I just wanted to mention on your sheet, you've got little tiny cells. They're called polar bodies. These polar bodies are the cells made by meiosis one and meiosis two, and they are junk cells. So they're too tiny to be fertilized. They wouldn't live long enough for fertilization to do anything for them. So they are basically discarded in a female's vaginal fluids. Now, you may wonder why we have them at all, and the whole goal is to contribute their cytoplasm, organelles, proteins to that really big secondary oocyte, because if fertilized, it won't die at the end of the 24-hour lifetime. It will actually live for 7 days, drifting down to the uterus, trying to bury in and create a blood connection with the mother. So it's got a 7-day trip, so it needs to have the goods inside to be able to survive. That's why we strip away all the excess chromosomes and donate them out here to these junk polar bodies. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so when you see the term ovum, you'll notice that ovum implies that we have a fertilized egg, and you're not gonna have an ovum unless fertilization has taken place. So secondary oocytes that are fertilized, finish meiosis two, and of course we have an ovum with a sperm inside. Give it a few hours and the sperm nucleus and the egg nucleus are going to fuse together, and now you have the first cell of a new generation. I'm almost out of room at the bottom here, but we call that new cell a zygote, and we're finally back to a diploid state. Ovum technically is haploid because the egg and sperm nucleus haven't fused. It's weird that when you think of fertilization, I would think that the nuclei would fuse right away, but apparently there's a delay in the two fusing. So yeah, ovum's haploid, sperm is haploid, and when those two nuclei fuse, boom, you've got yourself a diploid zygote. It is haploid, yeah, but the problem with it, it's a double-stranded cell.
So is it a zygote by the time it, like, implants?
It has actually gone to what they call a blastula stage. It looks like a soccer ball. It's got about 16 cells when it starts to get to the point of implantation, so it's moved beyond that point.
Yep.
No, don't worry about it. We don't cover embryology. So let me take you through the menstrual ovarian cycles. They're over a couple of pages. The information's written out for you, and then on page 138, there's an actual cycle for you to take a look at. The typical ovarian and menstrual cycles are on average around 28 days. So I mean on average because for a single female, they may vary from 25 days one month to 35 days another month. And there's no two averages that seem to be the same even for a single female. So the average number here, of course, is a 28-day cycle with ovulation occurring on or about day 14. So the ovaries, you'll notice here, have one cycle, and we follow the ovulated oocyte during that cycle. And then there's a menstrual cycle where we follow what's happening to the endometrial lining. So that's a separate cycle. Now, the ovaries actually run the process here because they secrete hormones that influence what's happening with the uterus. So I make the point because, you know, some women in their 60s may decide to have a baby. You've heard these stories, right? Somebody has their own grandkids for their daughter who can't carry their own babies. So the uterus can be used as a birthing womb even if the ovaries are no longer functional. So even after menopause, hormones can reactivate and make the uterus a functional womb once again. Who do the ovaries listen to? Hypothalamus and pituitary, yeah. So ultimately, GnRH, FSH, and LH are going to control what the ovaries do, and the ovaries dictate what happens with the uterus. So I want you to notice at day zero here, where the menstrual cycle has begun, the hormone levels for LH, FSH, estrogen, and progesterone are pretty much low across the board. During these days here, this is when a female has her menstrual flow, a period, the endometrial lining is sloughed off. And after about, say, 3 to 7 days, then we start to see an uptick in the lining thickness of the endometrium. All right, so if you take a look up at the top hormone levels there, as we approach day 14, what happens to your estrogen levels? Yeah, big spike in estrogen levels. And right after that, you'll notice there is a big peak in LH and FSH. So there's a positive, not a negative, but a positive feedback system that sets in place here. The more estrogen there is, the more likely we are to encourage FSH and LH production. So luteinizing hormone actually promotes ovulation. FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, does exactly what its name says. It helps to develop this growing follicle. So the uptick in those hormone levels will encourage around day 14 ovulation. What is the specific cell that's ovulated? Secondary, good. Secondary oocyte is ovulated. Diploid or haploid?
Haploid,
right. So the problem with it is it's still double-stranded, meaning it has one extra set of DNA that will have to peel away if fertilized. So right there, day 14, ovulation occurs. That is the end of the proliferative phase. The endometrial lining has been growing in anticipation of an ovulated egg. So that ovulated oocyte will drift in the fallopian tube, and it has about a day to be fertilized. So that one-day window is actually more than that because sperm live for 2 to 3 days. So sperm may be in the reproductive tract from 2 to 3 days earlier that can fertilize the egg up to about a day after ovulation. So there's more like a 4-day window there during which a female can have sex and ultimately fertilize her secondary oocyte. So the uterus, you'll notice, from day 14 to day 28, continues to increase the thickness of the uterus. Why? Yeah, prepare for implantation. It takes about 7 days from fertilization, around day 14, to around day 21 for implantation to occur, if it's going to occur at all. So you'll notice the endometrial lining is nice and thick in case that might happen. But when we follow the ovaries, you'll notice up here after ovulation, this red thing is actually our follicle. And after ovulation, if it's not fertilized, that oocyte will then die, and the follicle dies along with it. And so this follicle turns into a yellow body called a corpus luteum. And so the death of that ovary and its follicle leads to a decline in hormones. So notice you got FSH and LH that drop back down, progesterone and estrogen drop back down as well. And it's the decline in those hormones that lead to a menstrual cycle to start back at the beginning of the phase. But take a look at progesterone. I think this is interesting. After the ovulation period, why does progesterone stay as a high level? What does the body think might have happened?
Fertilization.
Yeah. So just in case you might get pregnant, progesterone levels stay high during the second half of your cycle. and that is just in case there's a pregnancy. So the corpus luteum is the one secreting that progesterone, and of course when it dies, there goes the progesterone levels as well. So normally in a pregnancy, the placenta will start producing progesterone, but that is the primary hormone for maintaining a pregnancy. Now, in women who experience PMS, you know, premenstrual syndrome, there's all sorts of things from mood swings to headaches to migraines, bloated, you know, situation. It's lovely to be a female, right? So these kinds of changes have to do with these hormonal swings that you see toward the latter end of this 28-day cycle. Progesterone, estrogen are steroids, so they do what steroids do, which is cause inflammation or reduce inflammation, but they do promote bloating and water retention. So that unfortunately is a side effect of having high levels of progesterone during the second half of that cycle. So I just want to kind of run you through that, make sure that you had an exposure to it. There is information in your course pack on the previous two pages that walks you through. Now, page 140 has some focus questions. You may want to review those, help you answer those for the final coming up next Wednesday. All right, so what kind of questions do you have so far on this reproductive stuff?
Just pretty much what you've gone over
is
what you're
going to talk about. Right. I wouldn't go through a whole lot of this stuff, you know, because it's only about maybe 10 questions on the final of this chapter at all. And then make sure you feel comfortable with the anatomy from lab. Right, because the anatomy from here should mirror image your lab anatomy. Kayla. It says on page 136, fertilization may occur up to 24 hours following ovulation. The oocyte only lives 24 hours. That's why it has to be that time window. Okay, so page 136, 24 hours is the time that that oocyte lives. I think the course pack is overwhelming to reread from beginning to end. I would retest those four tests at anything that's on D2L. Don't memorize the questions or their answers, but notice there are certain concepts that pop over and over. That's the kind of thing that I would try to train my brain not to stress during the test, pick the right answer, and be able to say, that's wrong, and I know why. So I think, and if there's something that maybe you never got straight or something that's kind of sticky, reread and then spot hit those areas where you need a little extra.
Do you make that
same? It is a departmental test. I have my final stamp of approval, I guess you'd say, over it. It's in my language, if that helps. So it's not in foreign people language. I've enjoyed having you guys this semester. If I can ever do anything to help you, my main office is over on main campus, 5416. I wish you guys lots of luck next week and as you further your career in education here. All right, I'll see y'all Wednesday
at 12:30.